This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today by telephone with the national chaplain of the Planned Parenthood Association, Reverend Ignacio Castuera. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Very good. We have a good connection. You're in Peoria, Illinois, as I understand it,
That's right, and you've been there the last couple days?
Yes, and
I preached today in a good United Methodist church since I'm a United Methodist pastor.
And you'll be coming to the Champaign-Urbana area in the next couple days
and
Bloomington area. And there are several events that you're going to be speaking at. We'll talk about that later. But for now, let's talk a little bit about Planned Parenthood. Why is there a national chaplain, in this case a Methodist minister, for Planned Parenthood?
Yes. Well, the history of the relationship between Planned Parenthood and progressive clergy goes back to the very beginning of the organization. Margaret Sanger, who was simply trying to educate women to the means through which they could pace the birth of their children, et cetera, et cetera. Was encountering at that time tremendous opposition, primarily from Roman Catholics. And so she knew that the Protestants and Jewish people would not share the same kinds of beliefs that Roman Catholics had at the time, the official beliefs. And so we have been staunch defenders. By we, I don't mean just United Methodists, but the major denominations have been staunch defenders and fellow workers, colleagues, of Planned Parenthood for a long, long time. We sort of went to sleep after Roe v. Wade was passed, thinking, okay, this is over. You know, we're modern. People accept the reality of a woman's right to control her fertility, et cetera, et cetera. There are so many other issues that progressive religious people need to address. We just kind of went to sleep on this one. We were doing a lot of other things, and we were jolted, really, from that when the movement became so violent that several clinics were bombed and physicians murdered and things of that nature. And that's when we sort of re-energized ourselves and began creating more visible presence for religious people in Planned Parenthood. But this is absolutely not new. It's just a return to the old love that we have had for each other for a long time.
Now, in terms of your being the national chaplain, tell our listeners a little bit of what your background has been. How did you come to this position? What had you done before?
That's good. Thank you. I was a member of the Religious Coalition for Abortion Rights. It's an organization that in about 12 years ago changed its name to Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. I was on the board at the time, and I came to the attention of people in Planned Parenthood who had formed a clergy advisory board for the national organization. And so I have been involved specifically since then, about 12 years ago. And when there was a retirement in the organization of the woman who was providing us with a lot of the logistical support, we suggested that there should be a chaplain. But the position remained open for a little while because funding issues and other kinds of things. And then I just put my name forth and did receive the position. My bishop, Bishop Marianne Swenson of the California Pacific Annual Conference of the United Methodist Church, appointed me immediately. She had absolutely no qualms about that. And the church I was serving at the time, St. John's United Methodist Church in Watts, also applauded my action and supported me as they continue to support me. My bishop and my congregation support me on what I do.
How long had you been pastor of the Methodist Church in Watts?
At the time that I started with Planned Parenthood's chaplain. See, I had been already 3.5 years pastor of that church.
And have you been in the Los Angeles, California area most of your ministry?
Yes, although I did serve a couple of years in Hawaii, and I'm originally from Mexico, so before I even went to seminary, I served a rural church in a little town called Coapiaxtla de Guerrero in the state of Puebla.
How many Protestants are there in Mexico?
A definite minority. I couldn't come up with a number, but a percentage, if we reach a 5%, it would be incredibly good.
Was your family Protestant?
They did become Protestant later on. I was the first one at the age of 13 to become a Methodist.
So your family was Roman Catholic?
Yes, I'm a baptized Catholic. I wanted to be a Jesuit priest. And at the age of 13, I decided that it was not for me, that I wanted a little bit more ability to... I didn't like the dogmatic positions that were taken then. This was long before John the 23rd, who was my favorite pope still. During John the 23rd, I was almost saying, gee, I should have stayed, you know. And then, of course, with the regressive positions of the last two popes, I'm glad I did what I did. But I have a lot of very good friends in the Catholic Church, priests and nuns and committed lay persons. By the way, Francis Kissling, who heads Catholics for Free Choice, is a very good friend. And Democratic Catholics in Massachusetts, I know the founder, and it's a very good organization. So it's not Catholic versus Protestant anymore. It is progressive versus not progressive or conservative or religious right or something along those lines.
Where did you go to seminary?
I went to Claremont in California. It's one of the official United Methodist seminaries.
And college before that?
I'm a product of the great education that used to exist in California during Pat Brown. I went to a junior college named Compton Junior College, and for $8.50 a semester. And then I went to Cal State Long Beach, graduated from there with a degree in social sciences.
How did you get the call to the ministry?
I told you that when I was a kid, when I was still Roman Catholic, I wanted to be a priest. And I think that sort of probably goes through the head of just about every Roman Catholic boy. I was an altar boy, and of course, the priests were highly respected in society and all of that, and they were nice and sweet and all of that, so I thought I would be a priest. And then when I became a Methodist, for a while I didn't even think about that possibility, and then later on, when I was about 16 years old, I felt a call to be in ordained ministry, and I wanted to actually stay in Mexico. I came to get my education here, but I wanted to return to Mexico and go on.
Are you married?
I am.
Children?
4, 32, 27, 21, and 12. So I plan my family very well. I believe in planned parenthood.
And in terms of the whole birth control emphasis of Planned Parenthood from Margaret Sanger's time on, when you were in a Methodist seminary, were these issues even talked about?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last part.
My question was, in seminary, when you were in seminary, were these kinds of human sexuality issues, like planning birth control and abortion, were those issues even talked about in seminary?
Yes, the especially the issues of family planning as they relate to the issues of injustice and poverty around the world. The Protestant missionaries, as they went to Latin America and Africa and many of those places and took birth control information, education, the means, et cetera, inevitably, the Protestant families did much better than the Catholics or whatever other religion happened to be in that town, because the families were smaller, and the families, because they love the Word of God, then they learned to read and write. And my sister learned to read and write from the Bible directly, for instance. And so the health issues that were addressed by the missionaries included the issues of family planning. And so, yes, of course, we were exposed to that as prospective pastors.
Now, how old were you when you left Mexico?
I was 18 years old.
Mm-hmm. And did you leave by yourself, or did some other family members?
My lonesome self. I came directly to an organization called Spanish American Institute, which was founded in 1911 by the Methodists, specifically to educate Mexican American children at the time, Mexican American boys specifically. The charter of that school said for vocational and industrial training. Even though the Methodists were kind, they were operating on the false assumption that Mexicans didn't have the brains to go to college. So they limited us at the time to, well, not me, because by the time I came it had changed, but they limited the aspirations of the Mexicans to vocational and industrial training. So,
and after being at that institute, how did you get into junior college?
The institute, by the time I got there, had already transformed itself into an international home. It was basically just the home where I lived. And I arrived, and 2 days later, I was 3 days later, I was in school at Compton College.
Tell us what you do as the national chaplain for Planned Parenthood Association. What kind of things do you occupy your time with?
Yeah, basically the following. One, to educate Planned Parenthood affiliates and members of Planned Parenthood to the history of the relationship between Planned Parenthood and progressive religious bodies. For most of the people who work at Planned Parenthood, religious people mean the picketers, the people who throw insults, et cetera, outside their affiliates and their clinics. I want them to know that it is a lot more nuanced than that, and that religious people have been on their side for a long, long time. Then conversely, I'm going to churches and other religious organizations to remind them of the long history that we have, a history that many of the people have forgotten because of the reasons I explained earlier, that long hiatus between 1973 to about 1994. So then I educate the churches to the good relation that we have had and try to energize them. And then finally, the third part is to try to educate the all-American centrist middle, which we have always had. I mean, I think we keep on talking about this polarized society in which we live, and I just don't see it. I know there are people that are polarized, but the center of America continues to be what the all-American center has been, reasonable, approachable, willing to learn, willing to move ahead, et cetera, willing to basically let people be people. And, you know, it's a very small fringe on either side that tries to derail things.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with the National Chaplain for Planned Parenthood Association, Reverend Ignacio Castuera. Let me just mention that he will be interviewed again on the radio here on WILL this Wednesday on Focus 580, and he'll be talking there about religion's role in human sexuality with David Inge, our host. And immediately following that, Reverend will be speaking at the University Y on campus at the University of Illinois about 12:30. So if there are people listening today who'd like to hear him again on the radio, that's Focus 580, Wednesday, a little bit after 11, with David Inge. And then he will be in person at the Y if you'd like to hear him talk and ask him questions. That's at 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign, starting at 12:30. That's on Wednesday, the 20th of September. He's also going to be speaking that evening at the Planned Parenthood Association gala. That'll be at the Levis Faculty Center at 6 o'clock, and that's a fundraiser. I think tickets are $75 for that, and you would need to call probably Monday if you want a chance to attend that gala. And then on the following day, he'll be speaking in Bloomington at at the East Central, at Le Chateau, 1601 Jumer Drive in Bloomington, for the East Central Illinois Gala. So two places for that, Champaign and Bloomington. If there are listeners who have questions or would like to make comments, do give us a call. This is a live program every Sunday evening here in coming from Champaign-Urbana. Wherever the program is heard, you may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station. In Champaign-Urbana, we encourage listeners to use one of the local lines, 333-9455. So in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Elsewhere, including listeners on the internet, may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And I see we have a caller already waiting on one of our local lines. Line number one, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest. Go right ahead.
Good evening. I wanted to recommend a book, actually, and perhaps both of you have read it already, but there are listeners, too. There's a U of I Press published a book a while back called The Brief Liberal Catholic Defense of Abortion.
Yes, thank you for mentioning
it. You know the book. Ah, well, it's quite a read. I'm no longer Catholic, so I read the first half. The second half is prescriptions, but the first half is descriptive about how sort of 17th century scientism actually...
Better than the modern things.
Excuse me?
Yes.
Led to the preoccupation with life beginning at conception. The historic belief, Aquinas and others wrote about it, that there was the quickening, and this is comparable
they
to
They were
what,
better than we are.
Yeah, I agree.
Tell us the title again, please.
It's A Brief Liberal Catholic Defense of Abortion, and actually the two gentlemen that wrote it are out in Northwest last I heard.
Seattle. They teach at Seattle University, which is a Jesuit university.
Uh-huh. they would be good guests because it's a complicated story. It's hard to synopsize, but it goes back into, you know, the 14th, 16th, 15th, 16th, 17th century and talks about how the attitude changed. I can't but make an aside here that those years were the Byzantines had already split off, but the Catholic Church was the only Christian church at the time, and of course we know that the sword was leading the cross all across Latin America through those centuries too, and I'm just aghast at the Pope's remarks.
To
point out the Muslims were doing something that the Catholic Church was doing exactly the same time is just, without pointing it out and saying a maxima culpa, mea maxima culpa as well, is outrageous. So I thank you for the time, and I really do recommend, I think it needs a much wider reading because it really...
Totally.
Very good.
Thank you. That is wonderful, and I do know... One of the two gentlemen that wrote that, he happens to be a process theologian, which I consider myself to be part of that movement as well. And some other time, perhaps we can go a little deeper into that. But yes, he is a wonderful human being. The wonderful thing also is that he is operating within the Catholic tradition, and that's why I was a little careful when I was saying, you know, John the 23rd, you know, versus today, and there are inside the Catholic Church cardinals such as Cardinal Martini in Milan, that who is a Jesuit, by the way, again, who has a completely different point of view than the Pope and the official position of the Church, which, by the way, is not the official position of the Church is not ex cathedra teaching, which means Roman Catholics who are informed disobey it consistently and are not sinning at all. I mean, the right after the encyclical De Humana Vita appeared, which is the one that went against the recommendation of the commission that the Pope had established, saying, do approve the pill and other methods of birth control, but specifically the pill, which, by the way, was invented by a Roman Catholic who observed the Mexican women chewing on a root that, you know, and that was a very folkloric, so to speak, way of establishing family planning over there. And so he felt it's a natural kind of thing, so he felt it was going to be approved. And he died a very unhappy man with his own church because the church did not approve it. But the moment the encyclical was published, the bishops, the councils of bishops of Belgium, of Canada, I think of the Netherlands also, said we don't agree with the teaching of the Pope. And in some ways, the Catholics in the United States have said the same. You know, more than 60, almost 70% of Catholics use some means of birth control.
When you talk about the difference between Protestants and Catholics, I think it's a little easy to assume that the majority of Protestants approve of abortion, though. Most Protestants clearly approve of birth control, but on the issue of abortion, there are many conservative Protestants who object to abortion.
Not a majority, by no means a majority. There is every major denomination has a statement supporting a woman's right to choose, which is different from a right from supporting abortion. I think if you ask individual persons, they may say, I don't support abortion, but I ain't going to get one. I'm a guy. So, but, you know, my issue is I support the opportunity that the woman should have to, should she find herself in a situation where she needs to have that medical intervention without the fear of dying in the streets as they were in 1972 in the United States of America.
Have you had opportunities for conversations other than the yelling matches with conservative Protestants who disagree with Planned Parenthood's position on this issue?
Yeah. There are conservative. Yeah, and they're loud, and they sound like a majority, but they are not. They continue. You know, we have to distinguish between anecdotal evidence and statistical results, and the statistics are on the side of choice, decidedly still.
Have you had any experience where people who've had such strong feelings about this have actually threatened violence toward you?
No, but they have sent me to hell several times. In Louisiana recently, I was called an apostate and things like that, which that's okay. No, thank goodness, no physical violence has ever been threatened against me. And, you know, I don't anticipate it either because I think the movement has grown and has realized that, again, that the all-American middle does not like that kind of idiocy. And you know, I think that we reach a bottom when those poor doctors were killed, Dr. Gunn in Florida, Dr. Aslapian in the Buffalo area. And I think that even the most rabid of anti-choice folks deplores that kind of behavior.
We have another caller waiting, again on a local line, line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Reverend Ignacio Castuera.
Yes, I'm fascinated with this program. My question to you is...
I can't quite hear. Can you speak a little louder?
Yes, I will. Was it difficult to switch from Catholic faith to Protestant one? Talk about that, please.
Oh, thank you. I was 13 years old, and I had been an altar boy, and I had really wanted to be a priest and all of that. And the decision itself was not difficult because what happened is I actually went to a party, not to a church first. It was a party at a church, but not to a church service. It was a Halloween party, interestingly enough. And I went with a lot of trepidation, but I went because I was invited by a girl. And I said, okay. And my mom gave me permission after I promised that I would not go into the sanctuary. But when I found such wonderful people, I went with trepidation because I had been given images of Protestants that were so unrealistic and so exaggerated and all that, that I began asking myself, why is it that religious leaders within my own religion need to be telling me these stories about the Protestants? What are they hiding? What's the problem? You know, here I was 13, but still, you know, I had to think about that. Now, you got to remember, 13 is a very important moment in the life of a young man or a young woman. You know, that's when bar mitzvahs happen in Judaism. That's a time when deep religious thoughts go through the minds of young people. And so the decision itself was not difficult because I said, why did they lie to me? That I've had it. That's it. And I announced it immediately at my home. That's when it got difficult, when my mom almost fainted, when members of my extended family began just talk about threatening. I mean, that's when it got threatening, you know. But the decision itself, the moment when I said, I'm not going to be part of this anymore, that was not difficult.
Thank you for that call. Let me repeat the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, to be on the air live with our guest from who's the National Chaplain for Planned Parenthood Association. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, it's a toll-free call, 1-800-222-9455. And incidentally, if you tuned in this program late and missed the first part and would like to hear it, these programs are archived on the Internet. And you may hear this program or others on Keeping the Faith by going to WILL.UIUC.edu, clicking on AM 580, and then going to Keeping the Faith to see the programs that are available to be listened to on your computer at your convenience. We're about halfway through our program, and we're talking by phone with our guest who's in Peoria, but who will be coming to Champaign-Urbana area and Bloomington area in the next 2 days. He'll be interviewed again on the radio, WILL AM Focus 580, with David Inge on Wednesday morning at a little bit after 11. He'll be speaking at the University YMCA at 1001 South Wright Street about 12:30 on Wednesday. If you'd like to come and meet our guest in person and talk with him and ask questions, you certainly are invited. No reservations necessary. You can pick up a lunch at the Y Eatery for good Thai food, if you'd like, or simply come and bring your own lunch, or simply come and hear our guest speak. He'll be also speaking at two gala functions at Planned Parenthood this Wednesday night at the Levis Faculty Center this Wednesday the 20th, and the following night in Bloomington at Le Chateau. It does require tickets for those galas. You may call Planned Parenthood for information, 217-359-8022. That's 217-359-8022 for information about those galas. I think it's $75 for a ticket, and should be a grand evening. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. I'm the director of the University YMCA, which is the oldest charity in this county. We've been here 133 years. The Y was started by students on this campus back in 1873. Some of our programs have lasted literally three-quarters of a century by this point. We've been active in this community, of course, for all that time. If you'd like more information about the Y and its programs, do go to our website, universityymca.org. You can learn about Friday forums, public lectures on important topics this fall. The topic is very important, the environment. And this coming Friday at the Y at noon, we'll be hearing about whose nature, whose rights, criticism leveled against white elitist forms of environmentalism, and the rise of the environmental justice movement worldwide. The speaker is a young professor from the Department of Sociology here at the University of Illinois, Zuza Gil. That's this Friday, September 22nd at the University Y at noon, Friday Forum. What on earth are we doing? Prospects for a healthy planet is the theme for this series of lectures on Fridays at the Y. Coming up before that, on this Tuesday, President Robert Exley of Parkland College will be our guest on Tuesday, noon at the Y, talking about Parkland and the University of Illinois. Success guaranteed. This year at the University of Illinois, there are about 900 transfer students. Many of those students have had 2 years of junior college, like at Parkland, at a community college, and then come to finish their degree at the University of Illinois. That partnership will be talked about by President Robert Exley of Parkland College this Tuesday. All these lectures are free, and it's easy to get to the Y if you're off campus by bus. So do consider public transportation, although there are some parking spaces available on the streets around the Y. We're located at the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street, 1001 South Wright. If you have questions, call the Y, 337-1500. One of the ways the Y has survived on this campus all these years are through the generous gifts of supporters. If you'd like to make a donation to the Y, give me a call, 217-337-1500. We also accept donations of vehicles. We have a vehicle donation program that takes cars and trucks and motorcycles, vans, boats, anything with a title. And we often sell them to students at a good price, and you can have a charitable deduction on your taxes, and students will get a good deal on a used vehicle. So if you have a vehicle that runs, do give us a call. The number I'm told for Planned Parenthood, for people who'd like to make a reservation for one of the dinners, is 359-4768. Sorry, I had the wrong information on that. Planned Parenthood, 359-4768 in area code 217. Well, let's get back to our guest today, the national chaplain, the first national chaplain for Planned Parenthood, Reverend Ignacio Castuera, who's a United Methodist clergy person. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're going to be talking about at the two evening events? The topic is religion's role in human sexuality, the education of our desire.
Yep.
Give people a little taste of what that'll be like.
Well, I think, again, like it happens with a lot of issues. We think we know what the position of a religion or an organization happens to be on a given issue, and the actual reality is that there are all kinds of nuances that are never shared, seen by the majority of the people. In some instances, even including members of the clergy, and I want to share the fact that the bulk, I think, of the religious tradition has had a support for a more enlightened perspective on our sexuality. I recognize that the official positions of some parts of Christianity and some parts of other religions might be regressive or not supportive of healthy and joyful sexuality. But I think, I wanted to say religion rather than just specifically Christianity, because when you look at the religions of the world, you find a lot of the religions, significant number of the religions saying very positive things about sexuality and being less restrictive than the popular kinds of perceptions that we have about religion. Now, specifically, education of desire is something that I came across after the Duke incident, where several students from the lacrosse team were accused of participating in some sexual improprieties, and the chaplain at the chapel in Duke, Dr. Wells, who is from England, by the way, gave a magnificent sermon. And even though he didn't use that as the title, I think in one of the paragraphs of what he said, he used that education of our desires, or close enough to that I decided to pursue a little bit more of what he was suggesting, and so that's where I'm going to go in the second half of the presentation there.
We have another caller waiting to speak with our guest. Let's go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes, I wonder if Reverend Castuera would talk a bit about another couple of books. One is Sacred Work, and one
yes,
is Sacred
great.
Places.
I'm sorry, I heard the first one, but not the second one. Sacred
I believe
Work.
It's Sacred Work, and one is Sacred Choices. One is written by...
That's Tom Davis's book, right?
Yes, I believe mm-hmm. so. And the other is McGuire, I believe. He was a Catholic priest,
Is the other one Sacred Choices?
Yes, I think
so. Yeah, by Dan McGuire?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, excellent.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that all of those suggestions are coming from the callers, not from me. Just in case I might have forgotten about that. Yeah, Tom Davis, by the way, is the chair of the Clergy Advisory Board of Planned Parenthood. And he was involved in this kind of work for many, many, many years. One of the things that that book states, which might come as a major surprise to most people, is that Planned Parenthood was actually nudged into entering the sacred work of also offering abortions for women, because they did not want to do it at the very beginning, even when it became legalized. The first group of people that offered abortions above the board was an organization of clergy people, a national organization of clergy people that was called the Clergy Consultation Services. And it was a counseling organization. It was started in New York, but eventually had chapters in more than 30 states. And just about every state legislature had exceptions. And one of the exceptions was that, you know, if the woman was psychologically unstable, well, you know, if you're in the midst of a crisis, it's not very difficult for a psychologist or a psychiatrist to certify that the woman is psychologically unstable, and then the pastors simply connected women in need with psychiatrists and psychologists that would be willing to sign such statements, and physicians that would go ahead and do the surgical procedure.
When the Clergy Consultation Services began in this country, it was at a time when abortions were illegal.
Before Roe v. Wade.
That's
was even
right.
Before Ronald Reagan
right.
In the state of California had signed the law making it legal for California women to have abortions. And by the way, that also gives me an opportunity to talk about the issue of justice. Part of the – yeah, I told you that the reason people got involved, the clergy people got involved in this, and the religious people got involved in this, was because of the injustice in there and because of the fact that so many women were dying. Now, the wealthy women were not dying. It was the poor women that were dying. The wealthy women could actually, on their own, find a couple of psychiatrists that would sign and do exactly the same thing that eventually the pastors began doing with the poorer women. Today, in El Salvador, we have the same kind of situation. The New York Times Magazine had this year an article about El Salvador, which has the harshest laws in Latin America. And the interesting and powerful thing about this article is that it was written by the very same man that had written an article about late-term abortions. This man actually witnessed a late-term abortion, fainted during it, wrote about it, and began, I think, turning the tide against the late-term abortions. Now he's also on the other side looking at this issue of no abortion whatsoever from the perspective of another country and say, do we want this in our own country? Do we want Louisiana to be like El Salvador, where the poor women risk their lives, die in many instances, and the wealthy women go to Miami, have a shopping spree, have the abortion, return home.
When you talk about the situation around the world, one of the important points that has come out in Al Gore's recent movie, An Inconvenient Truth, about the environmental crisis worldwide, is the problem with the explosive population around the world. How have religious groups dealt with this?
Well, thanks for that, too. I mean, that's another reason to be on the side of family planning, isn't it? I mean, this planet is limited. Regardless of how much propaganda we hear from the other side about the size of the pie can always get better and we can always get a technical solution, the reality is that a larger population will stress the resources of the world. And also, of course, now we know about global warming and all of those kinds of things. Interestingly enough, and thank God for this, religious conservatives are now splitting away from the religious right and the governmental connections that the religious right has precisely on that issue, on the fact that they're not taking seriously the environmental threats. Now, for us, I mean, let me tell you, in 1973, I was part of a committee that put together a conference in Claremont, California, called Alternatives to Catastrophe Conference. We've been ringing that bell for a long time, and we're glad that Mr. Gore and others are finally joining us. 1973. In 1971, the Club de Roma had commissioned a study which appeared under the title of Limits to Growth. And that report to the Club de Roma essentially said by 2021, we will almost destroy ourselves if the population curve remains, if the pollution curve remains, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we in 73 then had this conference called Alternatives to Catastrophe. And out of that whole effort, in 1973, Professor John Cobb, from the School of Theology at Claremont at the time, now he's emeritus, wrote a book called Is It Too Late? Back in 1973. So, I mean, progressive religious forces have been way ahead of the of governmental groups and others, you know, on this issue. And it's only lately that, you know, people on the conservative side are joining. I'm very happy to have them on board. But please, this issue has been before us for more than a quarter of a century.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith with the National Chaplain for Planned Parenthood Association. If you would like to make a comment or ask him a question, in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455, elsewhere toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Reverend Castuera, your mention of John Cobb, professor at Claremont, reminded me that you'd mentioned earlier process theology, and some of our listeners, that may be a new term. I know it's very difficult to explain process theology in a short, simple way, but give us a hint or two about some of the issues that are involved and why you find process Christian theology a helpful way to think.
Yes. Well, I was first attracted to process theology as a young student, because I was I wanted to make sure that my faith was reasonable faith. And I found that process theology paid close attention to the changes in perception of the universe from the perspective of physics and mathematics, that they were informed by Alfred North Whitehead, who was just about in every way the equal of Albert Einstein. That just, you know, called me to that kind of thinking. I was very blessed in that both at the junior college level and at the California State University in Long Beach, I was exposed to the thought of Whitehead, albeit in a more limited way, primarily around issues of education. And when I went to Claremont because Claremont offered me a scholarship, not because John Cobb was there. In fact, John Cobb was installed, the Ingraham Professor of Theology, the very same day that I first arrived at that seminary. And so I grew up theologically then surrounded by process thought. Now, what I would say that the most important things that I would want to share about process theology is that because it does take into account that the fact that the nature of the universe is that it is pulsating with life in every way, that at the electronic level there is life. By that I mean the electrons, the protons, at the cellular level, you know, that all life is all over the place. In a sense, interestingly enough, verifying or ratifying what we Westerners laughed at when we went to Africa or places in Latin America, and people talked about the fact that the trees had life, that, you know, the rocks were alive and all of that. And now, because of quantum theory, guess what? Yeah, they are alive. They're pulsating with energy, with life. And so that was one thing that really attracted me. The other thing that attracted me was that from my perspective, process theology solves the problem that has haunted all of the religions of the world, and that is the problem of evil. It's called the theodicy, and theology is called that. And the real problem has been this: if God is all that good, then why is there such evil? And God either has to be omnipotent or benevolent. God cannot be both. And so process theology said, guess what? It's better to give up on the idea of omnipotence and have God be a power among a variety of powers that is acting constantly on all of the universe, but that it doesn't have the absolute and total power to determine every cotton-picking event that goes on in every corner of the universe. And that was absolutely refreshing, to see that God is involved in every moment of experience, but it is not the only determinant force in that moment of experience. So that leaves room, of course, for human agency, human activity, and also, unfortunately, for the kind of evil that primarily males, that humans perpetuate upon one another. But I'd rather have that evil is explained on the basis of the unwillingness of humans to respond to the call of God to do the right thing, rather than because God just happened to look the other way while 6 million Jews were being gassed.
We have another caller waiting on our toll-free line number 4. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go right ahead.
Hello, I'm an atheist, and 6 million Jews being gassed wasn't done by God, because he doesn't exist.
I'm sorry, could you speak a little louder? I'm not with the radio, I'm with the phone, so I cannot quite hear well, so please.
Hello, can you hear me better now?
Much better.
Okay. 6 million Jews being gassed wasn't done by any God. It was done by Nazis.
Exactly.
My question to you is this, speaking as an atheist, if a human being is a human being, why is a fetus 8 or 9 months gone subject to abortion? Because you're killing a human being, and I have materialist views.
Well, I'm very happy to have an atheist online. I find that humanistic atheists, people that you obviously have some very strong moral convictions, and I'd rather have a person with strong moral convictions as part of a dialogue, whether or not that person believes in God. I find that most people who do not believe in God are pretty intelligent, but not necessarily have read as many other options of how to think about God. And earlier, I don't know if you were listening, but there was a gentleman that referred to a book called A Brief Liberal Catholic Defense of Abortion. And I think a lot of the answers to the question that you're making would be there. Now, when you're talking about an 8-month fetus,
viability.
Correct. Or any point after viability. First of all, we're talking about an extremely small percentage of all of the abortions performed in the world are performed at that point, and they're all tragic. The family does not want the abortion. Most of the people that I know that had to go through that had the crib bought, the room painted, et cetera, et cetera. That's what led, actually, the witnessing of so many of these women and men that came before the Senate during the years of the Clinton administration, when all of that was vetoed over and over again. It was because of these real stories of people who had hurt so much because of the late term abortions. I'm with you. I mean, I really wonder about that, but it happens to be at the very end of the pregnancies, and most of the time because of some catastrophic reason. It's not a whimsical reason at all.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. We're getting down to the last 6 or 7 minutes of the program. We could still squeeze in another call or two. 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free number. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. You were talking earlier about healthy and joyful sexuality. Many people feel that religious folks, whether liberal or conservative, don't talk much about healthy and joyful sexuality. Why do you think that is?
I think we do. I mean, I think that what happens is that we don't talk out loud. I think, you know, when you every time I'm with a bunch of ministers, we're talking about, you know, jokes that are a little on the risque side, and you know, I think that what we need to do is to make these things a little bit more public. I mean, I think that we need to just begin to kick out a lot of closets and say, come on, you know, tell people that you really enjoy this wonderful gift of God of human sexuality. What a wonderful privilege we have as human beings to be among the very few beings in creation that are sexual from utero to almost the grave. You know, I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, just and just to ignore this reality that we're so different from all of the other beings in creation, except for our close relatives, the chimpanzees and the dolphins, you know, and I mean that whole group of animals, you know, the primates and the cetaceans, you know, we're about the only ones that have sexual interests all year long, all life long, 24/7. What does that mean? Most of the time, you know, sexual interest has been linked with the devil and all of that. I don't believe that. We were not created by the devil. We were created by God. And it was God that gave us all of those nerve endings with which to experience that. And by the way, the largest sex organ is our skin. You know, and also the other extremely important sex organ, as Raquel Welch once pointed out, was between our ears, is our brain. So, I mean, let's be a little bit more thankful for the gift and humble and ask ourselves, I wonder what God intended for us to do with this incredible gift, rather than restricting and imposing all kinds of limits on the use of this incredible gift.
We have another caller on our toll-free line, line number 4. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Yeah, thank you for an excellent program, always excellent program. I think it's interesting that Viagra is sold so much, and yet birth control pills are...
Thank you. Yes, indeed. Isn't that interesting? And that the Pope or anybody said no, didn't say no to that one, right?
Yeah,
I mean, there was never even a commission for that.
And the pharmacists are, you know, some of them don't want to sell that, but I guess they don't mind selling Viagra.
Yeah.
You mentioned, and I missed it. I guess I lost my concentration there for a minute. You were talking about different ways of thinking of God and people who don't believe in God, but other views that they hadn't considered. And I belong to a group that discusses that, actually.
Of atheists?
A Methodist group. No. Just, you know, exploring different...
Different ways of thinking about God.
Other ways for people who don't believe in God.
Yes.
And you were talking about God being in everything, every aspect.
Yes.
That's smacks of Hinduism in a way.
Yes, indeed.
Uh-huh. Which is Process fine.
Thought is very compatible with Indian thinking. In fact, the next international meeting of the Whitehead Society, Alfred North Whitehead is basically the father of process thinking in general, and process philosophy is larger than process theology. Process theology is only part of that, but process philosophy includes belief in God. And the next meeting is going to be in Bangalore in India. And as the invitation was issued in Salzburg this year, and I had the honor to be there, the gentleman who said who issued the invitation said, "We want to welcome Whitehead to his land, the land with which he has the most affinity."
Ah, that's interesting.
Yes.
Yeah,
there are nuances, and you know, interestingly enough, process thought is just spreading incredibly in the Asian continent, including China.
Mm-hmm.
Professor John Cobb, whom I just mentioned recently returned from a trip there where he lectured, I think, 13 or 14 times in major universities in China.
Mm.
So I'm very, very excited about the fact that's happening there. Europe already is responding very well. For some strange reason, Britain and the United States are still kind of keeping a cautious watch on process thought. You know, the other people are seen, and I think primarily because of the polarization in the United States, we have not really had the time to really just sit down and think theologically.
Yes, I think.
Otherwise, I think that we would have more people in the United States.
I also think it's paradoxical that people, they accuse those of us that approve of abortion of, I can't think what I'm trying to say, but opposite. But I think that those who don't approve of abortion are perfectly willing to have animals suffer in the way that they're raised today and eat the animals. And
they,
we send are the ones that approve of sending our older kids to war.
Exactly.
And save them for that, you know. I just think it's the thinking is not clear through. Straight.
Yes, I don't know. The cover of Time magazine with the September 18, it has a Rolls-Royce grill with a cross on top of it, and it says, "Does God want you to be rich?" You know, and this thing about these people that say, "Yeah, you know, God wants you to be rich," but you know, people don't even think about it. Can everybody in the world have a Rolls-Royce, cross or no cross on it, and not degrade the environment the way we're degrading it? It's incredible that even the question is asked. I think the reverse is true. God doesn't want anybody to be poor. But I think that the excessive wealth that we have in some pockets of this nation, and that includes the rulers of this country, the excessive wealth, God would condemn it. Jesus definitely did condemn it.
I'm afraid we're out of time. I want to thank our caller and our other callers for today being on Keeping the Faith, and particularly our guest, Dr. Ignacio Castuera, National Chaplain for the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. If you'd like information about his speaking in Champaign and Bloomington later this week, call Planned Parenthood at 359-4768. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Forget the Middle East. Robert Kaplan says the war in Iraq is just a blip on the radar screen. The next U.S. military challenge will be in the Pacific, against China. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll look at a changing China from its military and economy to its literature. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
WILL programming is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake, suspension, preventative maintenance, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available, 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, showers and thunderstorms likely. The low in the upper 50s with west winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers in the morning. Cooler with a high in the lower 70s and west winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy and cooler. The low in the mid-40s with west winds around 10 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.
From WBEZ.